is Monday, March 12th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Martin Lumlin. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to the UBC campus and to residents of Vancouver and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:03 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus news and your local headlines.
UBC opened a new animal research facility last week. The $40 million Center for Comparative Medicine, CCM, will replace the Animal Care Center, which housed and distributed the university's research animals for over 30 years. Lucy McNeil, director of UBC Public Affairs, said the facility is an improvement on the old site. She said, quote, "The standards of this building surpass the standards set by the Canadian Council for Animal Care," end quote. While the facility is smaller than the ACC, the animal housing capacity has not changed. McNeil said the numbers fluctuate based on the size of the animals, but estimated that the facility could house, quote, "several hundred animals." But Stop UBC Animal Research said UBC shouldn't be spending money on a new facility like the CCM. Brian Vincent, director of Stop, said that the standards set by the Canadian Council for Animal Care, quote, "requires UBC to ultimately reduce the numbers of animals used in research. But it appears from the data UBC released last year that the numbers of animals used in research at UBC is increasing," end quote. The 3-hectare facility sits on the old site of the UBC Plants Op Nursery in South Campus, a few streets from the old Animal Care Center, which is set to be decommissioned. All animals have already been moved to the CCM.
The outgoing coordinator of the AMS Sexual Assault Support Center, Sharon Maluski, has resigned, citing a lack of support for the center from AMS staff. She said the center has received little support from permanent sub-staff since she was hired in October. The SASC provides support and referral services and runs information campaigns for people who have been sexually assaulted. Maluski said that there have been serious security concerns about the office that have not been addressed. She cited an incident from last August where an SASC staff person was reportedly assaulted while working alone. That person left her position shortly thereafter. A security camera for the office has yet to be installed, despite repeated efforts from AMS executives, including former AMS President Jeremy McElroy. In an email dated February 2nd, McElroy sent an email to AMS staff complaining about the lack of progress on the security cameras. Current AMS President Matt Parson said he hopes to address SASC's communication concern. He also said the AMS is working to hire a director for student services, the position senior to the SASC coordinator, but has encountered difficulties due to specialized nature of the job. The AMS said they plan to hire a manager before Maluski leaves on April 10th. Parson said there will be no disruption of service, and if a candidate cannot be found, the AMS will look to establish a contract with a third-party victim service worker.
On Sunday, the University of British Columbia honored the 19,000 people killed during the 9.0 magnitude earthquake and tsunami that struck Japan on March 11, 2011. Students rung the Pacific Bell outside the Asian Center on campus at 2:46 p.m., the exact time the earthquake initially struck the country. 1,000 origami cranes symbolizing well wishes to Japan were also placed at the memorial. The event was coordinated by students from the UBC Ritsumeikan Academic Exchange with the support of the UBC Department of Asian Studies, Institute of Asian Research, Canada-Japan Society of BC, the Vancouver Mokuyo Kai Society, UBC Asia Club, and the UBC Japan Association.
You probably heard it this morning, but a wind warning went into effect for Metro Vancouver today. Gusts up to 89 kilometers an hour hit Vancouver Airport, but it blew as hard as 110 kilometers per hour in Powell River and a truly impressive 187 kilometers an hour at Mary Island Lighthouse on the Sunshine Coast. The heavy winds caused havoc around the region, from Bowen Island to Sechelt, to right here in UBC and across Vancouver, with the area around Langara College and Vancouver's west side hit the hardest early this morning. Stanley Park was even shut down temporarily because of high winds, although the causeway remained open to through traffic. But while the park reopened around 1 p.m., the off-ramp into the park southbound from the causeway to Prospect Point remained closed because several large trees fell down. Crews couldn't be sent in to deal with the situation until the wind subsided. Several BC ferry trips were also canceled, and power was knocked out to more than 100,000 BC Hydro customers on the lower land, on the lower mainland and Vancouver Island.
And those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We'll now move on straight to the national news.
The federal government is set to introduce legislation to prevent a strike at Air Canada. Labour Minister Lisa Raitt told reporters in Ottawa today that an Air Canada strike could harm our fragile economic recovery. The legislation was introduced today and could take up to 2 days to pass. Now, last week, the government referred to file to the Canada Industrial Relations Board, CIRB, a movement to block job action as Air Canada hoped to lock out its pilots at the same time that machinists and ground crews were preparing to go on strike. The maneuver was successful. No work stoppage is lawfully possible while the board investigates. Meanwhile, employees of the airline stage a rally outside Montreal's Trudeau Airport. According to union spokesman Marcel Saint-Jean, workers are frustrated with the Tories' continual intervention in labor disputes, but they have no plans to upset the airline's operations.
It is D-Day for Bill C-10. The Conservatives' controversial omnibus crime bill will be put to a final vote in the House of Commons tonight. The Tories had originally planned to pass the bill last Wednesday, but the NDP was unable to delay the last day of debate until Friday and pushed the final vote to today. The bill was sent back to the House after the Senate made amendments to the portion of the legislation that allows Canadians to sue perpetrators and supporters of terrorism. NDP did everything in their power to delay the passing of this bill, including an effort to reject the Senate's amendments, but tonight, the inevitable is expected. Tonight, MPs will first vote on whether to accept the revised bill, then on the passing of this legislation into the law books. Because of their majority, the Conservatives are expected to defeat the motion and pass the bill that will make several substantial and controversial changes to our justice and correction systems.
The biggest class action lawsuit in Canadian history is underway at the Montreal courthouse today. A group of Quebecois smokers are challenging Canada's three largest cigarette companies in a lawsuit worth up to $27 billion. The group of smokers, representing about 2 million people, are claiming to have been duped by Imperial Tobacco, JTI McDonald, and Rothmans Benson & Hedges. The plaintiffs believe these companies did everything in their power to encourage addiction, including programming people through TV advertisements to make smoking seem cool. In their defense, some of these tobacco companies are saying that although the legality of cigarettes doesn't absolve them of liability, the dangerous consequences of smoking shouldn't fall solely on their shoulders either. Whatever comes of this case, it is sure to be drawn out. Due to the sheer volume of evidence to be presented, tobacco companies won't present their cases until next year. All of this comes at a time when six provinces, BC, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and Prince Edward Island, are teaming up to sue tobacco companies in an effort to recover billions of dollars worth of healthcare costs.
Automated form letters could be behind the majority of complaints regarding robocalls. Elections Canada announced today that a significant portion of the 31,000 messages they received concerning fraudulent phone calls were sent via automated forms. These form letters do not necessarily detail an allegation about a specific call, but merely raises concern about the subject. Elections Canada spokesman John Enright said many of the complaints were also Canadians simply calling to follow up on past complaints, which draw quite a bit of significance away from the multitude of accusations. The Conservatives tried to turn the tables on the scandal today, drawing attention towards automated calls the Liberals made in Guelph. It turns out volunteers for Frank Valeriotte's campaign were behind this recording that was sent out to Guelph voters, accusing the Conservative candidate Mark Burke of being anti-abortion.
I'm Lori McDonald of Guelph. I'm appalled by what I read in the Mercury today. I've been an advocate for women's rights for most of my life. Conservative candidate Marty Burke believes that under absolutely no circumstance should a woman have the right to choose. Government should not be able to force their beliefs onto me. We live in a multi-faith, multicultural society. Let's move forwards and not back. The race in Guelph is very close. Vote strategically on Monday to protect our hard-earned rights from the conservatives and Marty's extreme views.
Conservatives are saying Mr. Valeyrotte violated the Elections Act by failing to mention that the message was authorized by the candidate or the Liberal Party. So the plot has thickened regarding our little scandal. The Conservatives might have illegally impersonated Elections Canada in an effort to mislead voters, while the Liberals failed to identify themselves in a potentially libelous automated phone campaign. And Canadians apparently see nothing hypocritical in filing most of our complaints through automatic form letters that require no more thought than the simple click of a button. It's becoming pretty clear that fewer and fewer people in this country have the will or inclination to do anything themselves.
Those are your national headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
What does it take to change within? What is inner peace? What is our human potential? Experience the answers for yourself with free weekly sessions on self-knowledge for inner change. Sessions run weekly at the YWCA Hotel Meeting Room, 733 Beattie Street, starting Monday, January 23rd at 7 p.m., ending March 12th. Contact info at consciousrealization.com for more information.
CITR is your campus and community radio station, rocking out from room 233 in the sub from UBC's Point Grey campus. And this year, for 24 straight hours, starting midnight Monday, March 12th, students will be claiming the airwaves as their own. It's 24 hours of student power, and it's only on CITR 101.9 FM.
Summer, you get an A plus and 50 gold stars!
Boom.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. And now for your local weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, brought to you by Phil from the UBC Storm Club.
All right. Thank you, CJ. And good evening, listeners. Already mentioned by Martin in our program earlier, but man, what a windy morning we had today. At one point, gusting 80 kilometers per hour. Stanley Park was closed down for a few hours due to several fallen logs posing a danger to visitors and three TransLink bus routes, namely the 49th, the 100th, and the 401st, were temporarily rerouted to avoid fallen trees. However, in all honesty, compared to what's going on at Vancouver Island right now, our situation is really just a mild breeze. A deepening surface pressure low, described by Weather Canada meteorologist David Jones as a really sharp hook, moved over the region, bringing slicing winds of 110 kilometers per hour, resulting in power outages for more than 70,000 residents on the island, as well as the shutdown of 12 ferry routes. Our hearts go out to those caught in this terrible, terrible system, as BC Hydro's workers mobilize to repair the damages. Now, here's your five-day weekday weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, 40% chance of showers, low of 1. Tuesday, rain in the morning, totaling 5 millimeters of accumulated, high of 5, low of 2. Wednesday, rain up to 25 millimeters of accumulated, high of 6, low of 3. Thursday, rain up to 15 millimeters of accumulated, high of 9, low of 6. Friday, showers, high of 8, low of 7. So that's your 5-day weekday weather forecast for UBC, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently, it is 5 degrees Celsius here on campus. I'm with Martin, CJ, Iqbal, and Nina in the sub. For News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
Thank you, Phil, for that local weekday forecast. It's now time for your international news. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
A U.S. soldier killed 16 Afghan civilians yesterday in southern Afghanistan. The spree has strengthened major backlash from Afghanis against the U.S. and has also newly undermined the rationale of a war that a majority of Americans already believe isn't worth fighting. For more on this, we go to Al Jazeera.
Afghan security officials describe the mood in this village and across Kandahar province as tense. A lone U.S. soldier went on a shooting rampage, killing 16 villagers before dawn on Sunday. Witnesses say the heavily armed man roamed house to house, lining up, then shooting those inside. 9 children, 3 women and 4 men died. Signs of charring on blankets and on some of the bodies back up witness claims that the killer then set the dead on fire.
They killed a child who was 2 years old. Was this child Taliban? There is no Taliban here. Americans are always threatening us with dogs and helicopters during night raids.
As the scale of the attack becomes clear, the US government is moving quickly to try and limit the damage. President Barack Obama called Afghan President Hamid Karzai to offer his condolences and reaffirm what he described as his deep respect for the Afghan people. Anti-American sentiment was already high in Afghanistan after U.S. soldiers inadvertently burned copies of the Quran at Bagram Air Base last month. That set off protests and violence that claimed 41 Afghan lives. 6 U.S. service personnel were also killed in what appeared to be revenge attacks. 60% of Americans, according to the latest poll, have had enough and say the war in Afghanistan is not worth fighting.
Troops are under such tremendous pressure in Afghanistan. It's a war like no other war we've been involved in, but no one can condone or make any suggestion that what he did was right because it was absolutely wrong.
The American soldier responsible for the shootings is in military custody. He'll be held accountable under U.S. law, according to U.S. officials. A clear indication that the killer won't be handed over to the Afghan government. In Kandahar, Al Jazeera understands government agents are working among the community to try and stop protests breaking out. At the same time, the Taliban is vowing revenge for every one of the 16 people murdered. U.S.-Afghan relations have been deteriorating for months, if not years. The Quran burning and this latest shooting are at the top of a long list of grievances felt by Afghans. The U.S. had been hoping that ahead of a NATO summit in May, the Afghan president would agree to allow the U.S. military to maintain bases here beyond 2014. Hamid Karzai now says he's not ready to sign off on any such deal. Bernard Smith, Al Jazeera, Kabul.
Thank you to Al Jazeera for that report from Afghanistan. Let's face it, we are a frightening nation of dangerous thugs. There's at least one big dick who can attest to that. Former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney has cancelled a speaking engagement in Toronto because of security concerns, an event promoter announced today. Cheney was scheduled to speak at the Metro Toronto Convention Centre next month, but decided to call it off when memories of his last visit reduced him to rubble. Cheney visited Vancouver on September 26th last year, but the exclusive event was marred by demonstrators who blocked the entrance to the club and called for Cheney's arrest for war crimes. One man was even arrested for choking a club staff member. Cheney's people consider this a major security issue, so he won't be gracing us with his presence again, which has most of the country choked up beyond description. But there's good news. Those who bought tickets to the Cheney event in Toronto can get a full refund.
And now we go to Democracy Now!, where Amy Goodman, who interviewed Kathy Kelly, coordinator of an anti-military campaign called Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who has just returned from Afghanistan to stand trial for a role in a protest at a U.S. base over the use of drones. Kelly talks about the lesser-known humanitarian crisis among Afghan civilians, as well as the ever-increasing number of civilian casualties, as well as the U.S. military's continued drone warfare.
Go to here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we return to Kathy Kelly. Kathy Kelly, leading peace activist in this country, has just returned from Afghanistan. She is the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, speaking to us from Chicago. Kathy, what do you think, having just returned from Afghanistan, needs to happen there now?
I think it's important that people reinterpret the understanding of security. The United States continually pours funding into the Afghan National Police Force, into the Afghan National Security Forces, into forces that will secure the Tapi pipeline, for instance, and the Afghan local police, the Arvakai. And it's as though the only kind of security is that which comes from one group having heavier arms and more weapons and ammunition and so-called training than another. But what about health security and food security? And what about the fact that it's claimed by numerous human rights groups that children in Afghanistan are starving to death at the rate of 250 per day, according to some? The United States has, I think, done its best to secure the potential for a roadway, the pipeline, the Turkmenistan-Afghanistan-Pakistan-India pipeline, 450 bases that might be maintained, huge prisons. They're still spending $100 million on construction of a new prison near the Bagram Air Force Base. And meanwhile, the conditions in Afghanistan are deplorable. People have endured a very harsh winter, as Democracy Now! Has covered several times. And the rage that people understandably feel when $2 billion is being spent per week on maintaining an occupation, while people within Afghanistan are desperate just to try to find food to feed their families, it's something that all of the surveillance and the analysis that the United States studies simply won't understand. I mean, the RAND Corporation has said that even though there are already 65,000 to 70,000 analysts poring over the surveillance supplied by drones that fly over Afghanistan, it would take 100,000 analysts to understand patterns of life in Afghanistan. Well, that must sound very absurd to people living within Afghanistan. When is the United States going to understand the rage and the antagonism felt by civilians who've borne year after year after year of attacks, unprovoked and uncaused attacks against civilians, as the United States has used its occupation to try to dictate the future of people in Afghanistan?
On CBS's Face the Nation Sunday, Republican presidential contender Newt Gingrich responded to the shootings this weekend in Afghanistan.
Well, I think you have to reassure the Afghan people that there will be transparency, that justice will be done. We're the opposite from Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. They kill civilians deliberately. We protect civilians, and when a tragedy like this occurs, we have an absolute obligation to deal with it out in the open, and to do so to ensure that justice is done and that they know how serious we are about protecting the innocent of every background and every nationality.
CBS's Bob Schieffer pointed out Gingrich took a different view when Obama apologized over the burning of the Qurans. This is how Gingrich responded.
Well, look, this is a totally different situation. With the burning of the Quran, they were killing young Americans. And no American president should apologize to people who are in the process of killing young Americans. This is a different situation. We obviously want to offer condolences to the families. I think we want to offer compensation. We want to recognize this is a terrible event. And as I said, we are in the business worldwide of protecting the innocent. Our enemies, the terrorists, are in the business worldwide of killing the innocent. And we need to make very clear that moral distinction. And then we have to live up to that distinction.
And Bob Schieffer also asked Gingrich if he thought it was time to leave Afghanistan now.
I think it is. I think that we have to reassess the entire region. I think the revelations about Pakistan having hidden bin Laden for 7 years in a military city near their National Defense University, and then hunting down not the people who were protecting bin Laden, but hunting down the people who were helping America. I think the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, when you look around the region, this is going to get much worse. It's why I've called for an American energy policy. We need to decide that we're going to produce our own oil, and we're going to, frankly, be capable of surviving without having to define or dominate the region, because I don't think we have the willpower or the capacity to do the things you'd have to do to fundamentally change the region.
That was Newt Gingrich on Sunday. Kathy Kelly, your response.
Well, I think as long as the United States military and foreign policy elites can present the war in Afghanistan as basically a humanitarian war, what they get in return is vast indifference on the part of the United States public. I think that many people in the United States public are weary of the war, but they don't want to abandon people in Afghanistan because they've been told again and again that we're protecting innocent civilians. It's not true. February 8th, helicopter gunships slaughtered 8 shepherds on a mountainside as they were out grazing their flocks. Just 3 days ago in Kapisa, 4 civilians were killed, mistaken for insurgents. This goes on month after month after month. President Karzai has begged that the killing of civilians must stop, and there's always some sort of an apology given, and yet these killings continue. And why is the United States in Afghanistan? I believe that the United States knows that it can't go after China or Russia, but they want to be able to continue a Cold War and have a leg up on China by being able to control the pricing and the flow of resources that would course through Afghanistan. And for this reason, the United States wants to secure its bases, its forward operating bases, its prisons, and what will become an even larger embassy than the one that was built in Baghdad. And meanwhile, the United States public is poorly informed. The media very rarely gives adequate coverage to the effect of the warfare on the ordinary people in Afghanistan. And what's more, the strategic partnership agreement has never even been brought before the Afghan parliament. The United States wants to ram that agreement through before the NATO summit that is planned for Chicago. They want to be able to say it's a done deal, that they can keep their troops in Afghanistan until 2024 and beyond, and NATO troops as well. And when would the ordinary people in Afghanistan ever get a chance to be involved in some kind of a referendum or some kind of representation in these kinds of decisions?
Kathy, you have returned home where you had to go a week or two ago to Syracuse, New York, to stand trial for a drone protest you were involved with. Explain that protest and what happened.
Well, in the Hancock Field in Syracuse, workers go in and their job involves flying weaponized drones over Afghanistan. And if they're given the order to fire Hellfire missiles or drop a 500-pound bomb, then that's part of the daily work. And so wanting to call attention to the increased reliance on drone warfare and a new kind of robotization of the United States military, which ought to be discussed here in the United States by the U.S. public and the Congress and the Senate, we staged a die-in. We laid down in front of the base. We didn't cause any obstruction to entrance to the base because the police themselves had blocked off the roads. Anyway, the judge in our case listened to 41 hours of testimony, including testimony from former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. He nevertheless found all of the defendants guilty. He did not give credence to what we believe was our duty under international law to stand up to the United States government and call attention to these violations of international law that the drone warfare represent. The judge had imposed penalties, including jail time, on previous defendants, but most recently he didn't do that. He imposed financial penalties, fines, and we won't pay those fines. We don't believe that we were guilty of a crime, and in fact, a good number of those who went before the judge told the judge, we'll send that money to young people in Afghanistan working for peaceful causes.
You've just heard about the drone attacks in Yemen, as well as Afghanistan, Pakistan. Are you calling for the U.S. troops to leave Afghanistan now? And what do you think would happen if they were gone?
Yes, I think that the United States should withdraw the troops from Afghanistan, but I believe the United States should pay reparations along with other countries that have invaded and occupied and wrecked and created carnage in Afghanistan. And so I'm thinking of Russia, I'm thinking of Pakistan. All of these countries should be responsible to pay reparations for the suffering caused. And that money should be entrusted to people in Afghanistan who've had a track record of being able to sustain humanitarian work, and possibly to other NGOs, but not to the United States, not given the abysmal track record of the United States in the expenditures of billions and billions of dollars that have helped to fuel corruption. So yes, I believe the United States troops should leave, and the United States should try to understand security for Afghans, not only in terms of militarism, but food security, health security, availability of clean water, availability of electricity. I was just recently in Afghanistan. People, including ourselves, in the place where I stayed with the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers, were melting snow in order to have access to water. Mm.
Kathy Kelly, I want to thank you very much for being with us, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, a campaign to end U.S. military and economic warfare. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 1,000 stations.
And thank you very much to Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman for that very special piece. We're going to take a quick little departure from international news and go back to provincial matters, with the BC legislature set to put a fast forward on Bill C-22 in an effort to pass it by Thursday. We had a chance to speak with a professor of constitutional law and socioeconomic issues here at UBC, Joel Bacan, and here's our interview with him. The government just announced today that they're going to sort of speed through Bill 22 and try and pass it by Thursday. But there are portions of that bill that are that don't really line up with federal law. Is that right?
Well, there are portions of the bill that don't line up with the Constitution, and in particular the Charter's guarantee of freedom of association. At least that's my read of it.
It does not seem like it's it's a little odd that we're sort of complacent about the BC government passing a piece of legislation that doesn't coincide with Canadian law.
The teachers certainly aren't complacent. They have been making an issue about Bill 22 since when it was first proposed. It can be challenged both on political and legal grounds, and I think that they have expressed their concerns on both grounds.
Well, there's also the matter of the Labor Relations Board. Are they a branch of the government, or are they an independent body?
The Provincial Labor Relations Board is an independent, it's a branch of the government, but it doesn't function under the government's political direction. Its basic job is to interpret and apply the province's labor relations laws. And what it has done to this point is it's provided a sort of compromise solution whereby the teachers have a right to strike for 3 days initially, which they've already done, and then to strike for a day in subsequent weeks if they give sufficient notice. So it's tried to both give effect to the rights of the teachers to strike and at the same time try to protect the various interests, including those of students, et cetera, that are affected by the strike. What is happening with Bill 22 is the government is basically overriding that solution of the labor boards with new legislation. And what Bill 22 would do is it would completely take away for a period of time, the teachers' right to strike. And as well as doing that, it would take certain issues off the bargaining table for 2 years, certain issues that the teachers believe are central issues to their ability to bargain collectively. And it's that aspect of the law that I've identified as problematic constitutionally, because our Supreme Court of Canada has said that the Charter requires that public sector employees be able to bargain about issues that are central to their workplace and to their working conditions. And this government has basically decided to take certain issues that are central to teachers' workplace and working conditions, issues around class size and composition, for example. What Bill 22 does is it takes those off the bargaining table, and it's that aspect of the bill that I've suggested is problematic from a constitutional perspective.
It's tough to understand that the government has the right to disregard Supreme Court decisions like that.
Well, you know, the thing about law and constitutional law is it's always a matter of interpretation. And the government, you know, has its legal advisors, and there are arguments to be made that that Bill 22 is sufficiently different than the bill that was struck down by BC Supreme Court just 11 months ago of this government, and also the bills of this government that were struck down by the Canadian, by the Supreme Court of Canada back in 2007. My opinion, my read of this legislation is that it's essentially the same as those cases previously struck down, and that therefore a court following those precedents, which courts are obliged to do, would find that this law is constitutionally invalid as well. Now, obviously, the government is getting different legal advice, or perhaps it's getting similar legal advice, but not following it. I really don't know. But I think that if you asked the minister, you know, are you acting unconstitutionally, he would say no, and here's my argument why. And I guess what I would say as a constitutional law scholar is he has an argument, but it's not a very strong argument compared to the argument on the other side.
So it could be a viable option for teachers to challenge this bill on the grounds that it is unconstitutional in court.
Well, yeah, there are two ways the bill can get to court. One way is to wait until it becomes law, and then the government, then teachers through their union, the BCTF, to take the government to court and work their way through the various appeals courts to a decision. The other way that this could get into court, which you know, I would think would be a good idea, though an unlikely one, is for the government itself to refer the legislation to the Court of Appeal in the province and ask for an opinion as to whether it's constitutional or not. This is a procedure that's available to the government. As I say, it's unlikely they would use it, but I think this would be exactly the kind of time and place where the reference procedure would be a pretty efficient way to get a fairly quick opinion about the constitutionality of this law.
So the only way that the teachers could hire a lawyer and bring this before the courts would be to navigate through the appeal system?
Well, they would have to initially bring it to the trial division, in effect, of the BC Supreme Court, and then a decision of that court would potentially be appealable by either the government or the union, depending on who won, to the Court of Appeal and the BC Court of Appeal, and then a decision of that court would be appealable to the Supreme Court of Canada. The way these things work, you know, it will be a long time, probably far past the time of this labor dispute's life, before a decision of certainly of the Supreme Court of Canada and even the BC Court of Appeal. It'd be a long time before a decision's rendered.
But the danger is that if you don't do anything about it now, it sort of becomes a precedent and allows that to snowball, doesn't it?
I guess the danger is that if this law turns out to be unconstitutional, which I think there's a good case for it being, the danger is that many actions will have been taken under it that are constitutionally invalid, and yet they will have had the effect of depriving teachers of their collective bargaining rights in the meantime, and thereby shaping the relationship between the teachers and the government over the next couple of years. And those kinds of effects can't really be easily undone. And so then we look back and we say, gee whiz, you know, those effects were all sort of propagated under a law that has now been found to be unconstitutional. So, you know, what I would hope for is that either the government seek an opinion of a court using the reference procedure on whether or not this bill is constitutional, or that it simply try to respect the possibility of it being unconstitutional and not pass it.
So as far as, just to help me understand a little bit, the Labor Relations Board placing, aside from Bill 22, just placing the limitations on the frequency that they can strike, that's a fairly new thing in BC, isn't it? It's just a few years old, or has it always been like that?
Well, the Labor Relations Board always has the authority to try to hammer out some kind of a solution under an existing legislative framework that provides, that gives effect, in effect, to that legislative framework. And so that's not really new. And, you know, labor boards frequently will issue decisions that provide certain kinds of restrictions on the right to strike that are consistent with the legislation that they are that they're applying. So that's not terribly new, and I think it's important to keep in mind the separation between what the labor board has been doing, which is trying to give some effect to the teacher's ability to strike, versus what Bill 22 would do, which is to deny entirely the teacher's right and ability to strike. So that's kind of that's important to keep in mind. Bill 22 basically moves the goalposts. The goalposts currently say there is the possibility and the right of teachers to strike within certain limitations, and that's what the Labor Board has given effect to. Bill 22 would completely close off that possibility.
If the teachers decided to, if Bill 22 is passed and the teachers decided to disregard it with a full-on strike, it would be reasonable to assume, I think, that they couldn't possibly bring all 41,000 of the teachers to justice with all those ridiculous fines. Is there any precedent for this happening in the province?
No, the fines are really quite draconian, I think that I think the government could quite easily bring the union, could go after the union for $1.3 million a day. It could quite easily go after union officers for the stated $2,500 a day. And it could, selectively go after some of those 41,000 teachers for the close to $500 fines a day. So, if the bill does go through, I think it would be a very risky, action to defy it. These are very substantial fines. They're potentially life-ruining fines for individuals. The government has the authority under this legislation, and it has the enforcement capacity to collect these fines. I think in any attempt to do so, the legislation would probably be challenged as unconstitutional. But it's possible that that even if some other provisions of the law, the ones that take issues off the bargaining table, were found unconstitutional, it's possible that a court would find the restrictions on the right to strike not to be unconstitutional. So it would be a risky action for individuals or groups to defy this law.
It could potentially instigate that whole appeals process, but the bottom line is that to stop this law from going into this legislation from becoming law, it would take significant legal action.
It'd be very difficult to stop it from becoming law, short of the government deciding not to make it law. The possibility of constitutional challenge really happens once it's made law. Unless the government decided, okay, we're going to suspend the possibility of making this law until we've heard from the court as to whether it's constitutional, and it proceeded with the reference procedure. But I don't see any...
Not necessarily.
I don't see any evidence that this government is interested in doing that.
No. Well, thanks a lot for speaking to me. Is there anything else that we should maybe hit on that I may have...
I think that's great. I appreciate you giving me a call.
Well, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Have a good day. Bye.
That was Joel Bakken, professor here at UBC, who writes and researches in the areas of constitutional law, socio-legal studies, legal theory, and economic law.
And now, for more international headlines, we go to Free Speech Radio News.
I'm George Lavender, with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Yemen, US drone attacks over the past 3 days have killed more than 50 people, according to government officials. Yemeni officials told AFP that 18 militants died on Saturday in an attack in the south of the country. Residents of Abyan and Al Bayda provinces say that US and Yemeni warplanes have carried out several attacks in recent days. British Foreign Secretary William Hague is being sued for his government's involvement in drone strikes in Pakistan. The case is being brought in the High Court on behalf of Noor Khan, whose father was among those killed in Pakistan's North Waziristan region. According to lawyers involved in the case, Malik Dawood was taking part in a meeting with tribal elders when he was killed in a US drone attack. Khan's lawyers want to find out if British intelligence was passed to the US government to help carry out the attack. They say British officials who helped the US military carry out drone attacks may be liable as secondary parties to murder. Campaigners hope the case will shed light on Britain's involvement in the highly secretive drone program. According to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, as many as 3,000 people have been killed in Pakistan since the US began using pilotless drones to carry out attacks in 2004. An Egyptian military tribunal has acquitted an army doctor accused of forcibly carrying out so-called virginity tests on female protesters. The decision comes just days after an Egyptian police captain accused of killing demonstrators last year was also acquitted. From Cairo, FSRN's Noel King reports.
The charge of public obscenity against Ahmed Adel was brought by Samira Ibrahim, who said the army doctor forced her to undergo a virginity test. Ibrahim and six other women say they were subjected to the tests, which they call a humiliating violation of their rights. In December, a Cairo administrative court ruled that the tests were illegal in Egypt, but on Sunday, the military court acquitted Dr. Ahmed Adel because witnesses in the case contradicted themselves during testimony. The court said it had no proof the tests had taken place. The army initially denied conducting the tests, but a senior officer later told Amnesty International that several women were forced to undergo the ordeal. The verdict outraged Egypt's activist community. Human rights groups say the verdict is another example of repressive practices, which they say have been rampant since the military council took control of Egypt following the overthrow of President Mubarak last year. In a message on Twitter, Samira Ibrahim wrote, "No one stained my honor. The one that had her honor stained is Egypt." She said she would carry on until Egypt's rights were restored. The verdict cannot be appealed. Noel King, FSRN, Cairo.
A new European Union policy requiring airline companies to pay for their carbon emissions is facing increasing opposition from the aviation industry and foreign governments. From France, FSRN's Liam Moriarty has more.
Air France, Lufthansa, and other European airlines have all sent letters to government officials in France, Germany, the UK, and Spain. They say they're being caught in the crossfire between EU climate policy and foreign governments that object to the new emission charges. Airplane manufacturer Airbus says sales worth 12 billion euros are being held up by Chinese officials. They claim that China, which objects to the carbon charge, is trying to put pressure on Europe to drop the policy. Airbus spokesperson Marianne Gretchen says the industry stands to get hurt.
We've got 1,000 jobs at Airbus alone that are in jeopardy, another 1,000 that are in danger with our suppliers, and our airlines simply can't do business the way they should be able to do business in that part of the world.
Airbus and other aviation companies want the EU to seek a compromise that will head off punitive trade sanctions. But EU climate officials have so far stood their ground. They agree an international agreement to cut carbon emissions from the aviation industry would be the best solution, and they say they're ready to work toward one. But until the rest of the world is willing to adopt a policy at least as stringent as Europe's, they say the EU law will stand. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
U.S. civil rights advocates will be at the U.N. Human Rights Council in Geneva this week, raising concerns about the growing number of states passing voter ID laws. The NAACP says the new laws are taking away the right to vote from millions of Americans. According to a report by the Brennan Center for Justice, millions of people could be affected by voter access legislation passed by 14 states last year. Changes include mandatory photo ID checks for voters and shortened early voting periods, both of which are disproportionately used by black and elderly voters. Two states, Florida and Texas, made it harder for convicted felons to regain their right to vote. The UN Human Rights Council has no power over state governments, but the NAACP hopes that they will put pressure on them to change. And those are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. I'm George Lavender.
Tensions continue to rise in the Middle East on a fourth day of Israeli airstrikes on Gaza and rocket fire from armed Palestinian factions into Israel. More than 20 Gazans have been killed and dozens injured. The violence started last Friday after Israeli forces killed a leader of the Popular Resistance Committees and his son-in-law in what appeared to be a targeted assassination. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
According to Hamas-led medical sources, Israeli airstrikes have killed 23 Palestinians, including three children, three elderly people, and a woman. Women and children are also among more than 80 people injured, some critically. At the Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, 14-year-old Saleh Karmoud lays silently on a hospital bed. Saleh's legs are fractured, and his abdomen was hit by a missile's shrapnel in an Israeli strike on their northern neighborhood of Al Twam. Karmoud's brother Hammam describes what happened.
He was returning back home from school along with his fellow students. When an Israeli drone's missile hit them all, five were injured and the sixth was killed.
An Israeli army spokesperson denied the army operated in northern Gaza the moment the six schoolboys were hit. In another Israeli airstrike Monday, an elderly man and his daughter were killed in the northern neighborhood of Tal el-Zatar. Dr. Ayman al-Sahbani is a chief for the emergency department at the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, where many of the killed and wounded are taken.
The injuries are variable. Today we received six injured children. Three of them underwent immediate surgeries. All of them had bruises and shrapnel all over their bodies. Many of the injuries are centered in people's heads. Some of those killed were decapitated.
Gaza-based armed factions, including the Islamic Jihad and the Popular Resistance Committees, have responded by firing dozens of homemade rockets each day into nearby Israeli areas, some of them longer range. Israeli media reports say Palestinian rocket fire injured two Israelis, including a woman, Monday, and damaged a building and cars in Ashdod City, about 25 miles away from Gaza. Rami Almighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Today, the UN's top humanitarian official described the devastation she witnessed during a visit to Syria's city of Homs after a month-long bombardment by government forces that activists say killed hundreds.
In Baba Amma, I was horrified by the destruction I saw. No building was untouched, and there was clear evidence of the use of heavy artillery and tanks. Baba Amma was almost deserted, a few people in tears as they tried to salvage a few possessions.
Valerie Amos, UN Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, said she was concerned about the 50 to 60,000 people that used to live in the area and are now unaccounted for. She said residents in Syria are in urgent need of humanitarian supplies and medical attention. Also today, activists in Syria reported attacks and raids in cities throughout the country. Four children aged 5 to 6 were some of the 16 confirmed killed in the Homs neighborhood of Ashira, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. More deaths were reported in Damascus, Aleppo, and other cities. The group also reported security forces arrested 35 people from a mountain village in the northern Idlib district and said they were detaining the villagers as hostages. This followed